nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
All right, so I guess you saw in the last two lectures talking about force distance, FD versus FZ curves. Any questions? Do you guys understand the difference between FZ and FD now? That audience. So either the answer to the question is, I don't have any questions, or the answer is, I have a question. So the answer is going to be zero or one. One question or zero questions. It has to be an answer. Do you guys understand it? Okay, zero questions. Is that the answer? All right. Very, very important. Don't be shy. Don't be bashful. You know, come out and ask your questions. Because if you don't understand it, you're not going to follow what's coming next. So this is the time. Okay? All right. Let's do a quick review, just in case you still have some questions. And the idea is that the lowercase d is basically the gap between the tip and the sample. When d is positive, you have a gap. When d is negative, you're indenting the sample, okay? So f versus d is this fundamental quantity, a curve that represents the net force between these 10 to 100 atoms in the tip, 10 to 100 atoms in the sample. F versus d is a fundamental property of the surface, of the interaction between the tip and the sample, when you measure the aggregate force versus separation, okay, FD. However, in an AFM experiments, you don't control the D directly. What you control is you've got this tip is sitting on a cantilever. What you do is you move the base of the cantilever up and down, or you move the sample up and down. That motion is called the Z piezo displacement. Now, when you change Z, if the cantilever were perfectly rigid, changing Z is the same as controlling D, as changing D, if the cantilever is rigid. But cantilever is not rigid. It's got a stiffness. So as you change Z, what ends up happening is you change the interaction forces, the cantilever starts bending, so the D changes disproportionately from Z. So Z and D are different things, basically. So we talked about two things. One, in theory, for example, using the things that Professor Raffenberger has talked about, let's say you know F versus D, okay? Then we talked in the last class about how you would convert the F versus D to F versus Z. The process basically involves a simple force balance, right? What you're trying to do is, if you make a free body diagram of the tip, you got a restoring force pulling it up, which is cantilever stiffness times delta. Delta is the deflection of the cantilever, right? Bending of the cantilever due to the interaction force. So K delta is the force that the cantilever applies to the tip to pull it back up. FTSD is the tip-sample interaction force between the tip and the sample. So the tip equilibrates to a position to balance these two forces, right? So that's what we're asked to solve. For every Z, you would solve this equation, K delta equals FTSD. We showed you from basic geometry that delta, the cantilever deflection, is nothing but D minus Z, okay? D being the tip sample gap separation and Z being the Z motion, right? This was done. I hope you really understand this. It's essential to understand it, okay? If not, please talk to me after class. You really need to get this difference down. So if you look at this, what you're asked to solve is this equation K times D minus Z equals FTSD. So for every Z, you have to solve this equation to figure out what is the D value that you're going to come to or settle down to. That's it, okay? And the method I showed in the last lecture was done graphically. You look at left and right hand side, FTSD is some sort of a nonlinear function of D, and you look for an intersection of that with the curve on the left, which is a straight line. Intersection points will tell you the equilibrated location of D, Right? So that's what we did. So if you know FD, how do you go to FZ? Well, you do this, okay? In experiments, though, you measure FZ and you want to get to FD because you measure FZ and you want to back out of it some local mechanical property or some surface property. You want to go to FD. And when you do that, how you do it is you have F versus Z for every force. You plot along the x-axis the quantity delta plus Z, which is at every force, if you know what the Z value is, you add to it the cantilever deflection delta, and that gets you F versus D, okay? So there are two ways, one going from FD to FZ, the other FZ to FD. And what's really interesting about it is that when you start from FD, if I give you a theoretical FD, you can always, for a given cantilever stiffness, come up with a unique FZ. On the other hand, if I give you an FZ, I think I showed you an example that you can have different FDs that give you the same FZ. So to go from FZ to FD, which is what you do in experiments, is a little more complicated. If you missed that important point in the lecture, I will revisit it later this time. So let's go over, this was done in the last class, but let's do this in a little more detail. Okay, so on the top, you have an example of an FD curve, okay? So you have D is the separation between the tip and the sample. And this is an example of an infinitely stiff sample with no surface forces, okay? So if it's an infinitely stiff sample, what you expect is that and by the way, I've chosen D equal to zero. Remember, D equal to zero is somewhat arbitrary, and we can debate where it should be. But for simplicity, in the very top, I've chosen it to be exactly where the gap closes to zero. It's gap. D, I interpret as gap. Gap is zero means you're contacting the surface. Now, if it's an infinitely stiff sample, what's going to happen is, as soon as you close the gap, the resistance becomes infinite. It does not allow you to push any further, right? So, in other words, the slope of force versus D becomes infinity. That's what I would call an infinitely stiff spring, right? So if I assume the sample is like a spring and its stiffness is infinity, it means it doesn't indent. You cannot get negative D, right? It's infinitely stiff, so there's no indentation possible, right? So that would be the FD curve for a hypothetically infinitely stiff sample without any interaction forces, which means that even when D is greater than zero, there's no interaction. Okay? So the question is, given FD, can you try to sketch in your notes what FZ would look like? Take a minute and just try to sketch it out. Oh, you got it. You got it in your notes. Ah, goodness. All right. So this should not be as a surprise. This is what happens when you print things out. All the animations go away. Everything's printed out, right? This is the FZ you would expect. And obviously the curves look very different. Okay? Can someone explain to me why they're different? Non-AFM people. People who are not doing research on AFM currently. Alright, so this is absolutely critical, okay? What you do in an experiment is you're going to bring this cantilever down on this infinitely hard substrate, okay? So if you look at the right side of that curve, you're going to get zero. You see the zero force? The force is zero. And at a certain value of Z, you're going to contact the surface, okay? Right? Then the surface is infinitely stiff. But what you do when you change Z is you're moving either the sample up or you're moving the base of the cantilever down, okay? One of the two. It depends on your AFM system. Some AFM systems push the sample up, some push the base of the cantilever down. Once you've contacted, if you press the base of the cantilever down further, the sample is not deforming, right? Because this is infinitely stiff, right? So D is zero. It's not deforming. So the base is going down. So what is it that's deforming? It's the cantilever that's bending. So you move the base down, There's no deformation in the sample. All the deformation is in the cantilever. What you measure in an AFM is the bending of the cantilever. So once you're in touch and you push further, what you expect to see is the bending, the cantilever, the cantilever tip moves with respect to the base as much as you push down. So if Z goes down a certain amount, the tip relative to the base goes up by the same amount, right? So this is initial contact, and then I press Z down, let's say 10 nanometers. Well, this tip relative to the base of the cantilever goes up by 10, right? So what we measure in an AFM experiment is we change Z. So, Z can keep changing. Z can keep changing, up and down. But D remains zero all along. There's no indentation in the sample. So all the Z change goes into bending the cantilever. That's it. That's why, along the Z-axis, you can go up and down as much as you want. But what you end up getting, the force you measure, is going to be a straight line because the delta that you measure is going to be equal to Z. So in other words, when you touch the sample and move down, the amount you move down is exactly the amount by which the tip goes up relative to the base. So in the linear part of the slope, the amount of cantilever deflection equals the Z motion, right? That's the key thing. And what I've plotted along the y-axis is cantilever stiffness times delta. So remember, the amount of delta you get for the amount of Z is going to be 1:1 once you're on an infinitely hard substrate. And so the force is simply K times delta, which means the slope of that straight part is going to be K, okay? The cantilever stiffness, all right? This is what happens on an infinitely stiff sample. So this hopefully illustrates to you that when you do an FZ curve in experiments, you get the right-hand curve. Your interpretation of it should be left, on the left, FTS versus D. Completely different, okay? Let's look at the second example. The second example is an infinitely stiff sample with surface repulsive force. Now, why do I call it infinitely stiff? Because at the left side of it, it becomes vertical again, F versus D. In other words, I'm again not allowing D to become negative. It's so stiff, you cannot indent the sample, okay? So D is not zero. However, at some distance moving forward from D equal to zero, the tip starts experiencing some repulsive interaction, okay? This is the FD curve. Now, where does it arise? If any one of you does experiments in liquids, this happens all the time in liquids, okay? And it comes from many sources. It can come from, for example, if you've got some soft debris attached to the tip, like you're scanning a biological sample and you get a little piece of protein hanging at the end of it. Well, what's going to happen is, let's say you're trying to do a force distance curve on mica. You press and first that little squishy bit squishes and then you hit mica, which is effectively rigid, right? So you would get a gentle repulsive force due to the elasticity of that little squishy biological thing that you're looking at, and then you would go through and hit the hard object and you get effectively infinite stiffness, right? That's what would happen. Another good example in liquids is even if you don't have any soft debris attached to the tip, when you do this experiment under low concentration buffer solutions in liquids, you get electrostatic forces that come in liquids. We'll talk about this in detail, which are repulsive, interestingly. We'll talk about that later. So this is an infinitely stiff sample with surface repulsive force. The question is, what is the FZ going to look like for this if you did an experiment? The claim is it would look like this, okay? The idea is the dashed line here is basically a copy of the red line from the top. So what I've done here is superposed in the dashed line what should be the FZ curve if it were an infinitely stiff surface without any surface forces, okay? So what is happening is, of course, when you're way over to the right, when Z is large enough, there's no interaction force because your gap is pretty high, right? Separation is pretty high. As you come close to the sample, you see there's a gentle increase in interaction force. There's a gentle curve that comes in. But at the end of the day, As you press down further, you will have to hit that vertical wall. And when you hit the vertical wall in the FD, at some point, you're going to hit that vertical wall. And then beyond which, any further motion of Z, you get the same amount of cantilever deflection as the amount of ZPA's of motion. And you get this flat line, straight line, whose slope is again going to be the cantilever stiffness. Okay? All right? Okay. Let's take a look at the third example. Infinitely stiff sample with attractive Van der Waals force, okay? There's an example where you have, again, a vertical interaction force versus D. So this represents, let's say you got a sphere and you got a wall, a surface here, and you got some attractive Van der Waals forces. Let's say inverse square gap dependence like Professor Raffenberger talked about. But at some point you contact the surface and the surface is infinitely stiff again. So you have this kind of a behavior. And, you know, again, I've chosen D equal to zero arbitrarily at some point where, let's say, contact occurs and you don't have Van der Waals forces, you know, very active at that point. What would the FZ curve look like for this? So this case, I think we did in some detail last time. But again, whenever you're dealing with these infinitely stiff sample cases, it helps to first put in with the dashed line is the underlying response when you have a perfectly rigid sample without any interaction forces, right? The dashed line, okay? But I hope you understand now why you're going to get snap in and pull out. This is all discussed in the lectures before. No? I see five faces that are not, recognizing this. Do you guys know why, when you come in, there's going to be a snap in and there's going to be a multivalued curve when you come in and move away, FZ? Well, you need to look at the lecture again properly. We really can't go forward without this. Okay, but essentially, let me just give you a summary, and please go back to the lecture, watch it again if you haven't. Basically, remember what we're trying to do. If you try to follow this graphically, you're trying to look at the intersections of FD with a straight line, which is the slope of the cantilever restoring force, right? And if your Z is located out here somewhere, you know, as you come in, there's going to be a point where the elastic restoring force is no longer able to sustain the tip. In other words, the attractive force becomes so large that the repulsive force cannot sustain it, and it just snaps in. You bring it close, and it snaps into the sample. And when you move away, it snaps out. This has been described in 2-3 slides in the last lecture. Please go back and really look into it and ask me questions. This is ABC. If you don't know this, you won't go any further in AFM, okay? The important thing is that this happens even if the FD curve is single-valued, or, you know, FD curve does not show any hysteresis, but the FZ curve can show hysteresis, okay? Please go over it, ask me questions if needed. Last example is a pretty interesting example. This is going to be a FD curve where there is hysteresis in the FD curve. Now, you can get hysteresis in the FD curve, for example, here, due to a capillary force. So what that means is the tip comes in contact with the sample, and it's an infinitely stiff one, so straight line. D cannot be negative. It cannot indent. It's stiff. But as soon as it touches, if you're doing this experiment under ambient conditions, what happens is most surfaces have a layer of water on them. Most surfaces do. And for any finite relative humidity, there's water on top. So when you're in contact, the water molecules will quickly form a neck, like a meniscus. Professor Raffenberger talked about the meniscus force also. And so when you pull away, so when you come in, you follow this. When you pull away, you're trying to break a liquid neck. You start literally at a negative force until that neck pops and breaks, right? You'd follow the green line. when you come away. This is in the FD curve. If you now follow the same analogy and try to calculate the FZ corresponding to this FD, you will find the following. That upon approach, you follow red and you hit this infinitely rigid substrate, so you get a straight line again here, whose slope is K cantilever, but upon retraction, you would feel this green part of the curve, resulting in something like this. So you see a hysteresis in the FZ. Okay, but this hysteresis in FZ comes from a hysteresis in FD. So the whole point that I tried to emphasize last time was that just because you get a hysteresis in FZ doesn't tell you if it is due to hysteresis in FD due to meniscus effects or if it's simply due to plain good old Van der Waals forces, which is not hysteretic. We don't know. This is what I mean, that you can have two different FDs that give you the same FZ effectively. And this is where you have to use your experimental knowledge to say that, well, you know, I did my experiments in zero relative humidity, so this is completely ruled out. So if I do get a hysteresis there, it must be due to Van der Waals forces. If you don't use your experimental knowledge to sort it out, you cannot tell the difference what caused the hysteresis, okay? Any questions before we move on? These are very important examples, okay? Now let's go to soft materials. When you're dealing with soft materials, the first example on the left is a soft material with no surface forces. And here, D equal to zero is where the interaction begins. When D becomes negative, you're now indenting. You're allowed to indent the sample, okay? So this can be most soft materials, polymers, most biological specimens, whatever you're dealing with. Now, D can become negative, let's say. So you've got some funny response because it's a complicated material, you're indenting, can be funny things could happen. That's F versus D, okay? Now, let us convert that into FZ. Using the process in the first slide, and you would get this. This would be the FZ for it. The key thing to keep in mind is that I've drawn with the dotted line what response you would get if it were infinitely stiff. So it's good because now it's a compliant surface. It's good to compare FZ on a compliant surface versus FZ on an infinitely stiff substrate, right? On an infinitely stiff substrate, you get a straight line to the slope of K. K is the cantilever stiffness. But if it's compliant, what ends up happening is that for the same height, i.e. for the same force level, you find that your Z motion has actually indented the sample by an amount shown there, D. Okay? So in other words, what's happening is that, you know, this, you can sort of judge how compliant the sample is by looking at what is the deviation of the FZ curve from what you would expect in the ideally stiff case. In the ideally stiff case, it just goes and has a slope equal to cantilever stiffness, right? So this is the curve in the ideals. If it's a soft material, it starts at the same point, but lags behind a little further. And the difference is basically the indentation. So now what's happening is, as you press the surface, you know, as you contact the surface and press down, that Z motion goes into bending the cantilever, but also deforming the sample. Right? It goes into both. Right? Now, this is a typical curve you might get in your liquids and trying to indent on a soft material. Let's look at case two, which was done in the last class. This would be a soft material also, because you see the slope is not infinity. Whenever the slope is infinity, it's infinitely stiff. Right? So now the slope is not infinity. And you have an attractive Van der Waals force and a repulsive component. And I hope you now know that the FZ curve for this case, soft material with attractive force, will be this. We did it last time. When you come in, you follow red. The cantilever bends down until it snaps into the sample. When you pull away, it pulls out. Again, keep in mind that you get hysteresis in the FZ curve, even though the FD curve is non-hysteretic. This is very important, okay? And if you, this is an example where you get a soft material with a hysteretic FD curve. So this is what, for example, the JKR model would suggest. And this would again also give you a hysteretic FZ curve. And again, the point being that, you know, just because you have hysteresis in FZ doesn't allow you to conclude that FD is hysteretic. You have to use your knowledge of experimental conditions to say that, you know, my materials are too stiff. I've got zero relative humidity, so this cannot be FD. It must be that, right? So you have to use some knowledge of experimental conditions to judge where you're at. Okay, now I hope you've had your coffee in the morning, because I'm going to ask you to interpret or think about interpreting an FZ curve that is shown on the top left. This is from an old paper, 1989. Now, just want to point out that when you look up old literature, you know, if you read the article in the Reader, the article by Bud Capella and Kappel, it is an excellent, excellent, excellent piece. I mean, you should all, if there's one wish I have is all of you read that article, you'll be so much the wiser for it, okay? It's a huge article, a lot of information, really good article. So, Capella and Kappel, they really lay out very specific terminology. They call it Z piezo displacement. In the literature, you'll see the Z referred to by all kinds of names. Some people will call it gap, dip sample gap. It's not dip sample gap, as we've discussed. Dip sample gap is D, right? But some people will call it, in this case, sample position. So people call it all kinds of things. Capella and Kappel really have it down very precise. It's Z piezo displacement. Okay. So just be aware of that. So let's take a look at this. What you've got along the y-axis is not the force, but cantilever deflection. But that's okay. To get force, you just multiply cantilever deflection by the stiffness, okay? So effectively, the y-axis is the force. So you've got force Fz. Try to interpret that for me, if you will. Arrows show you approach, and retraction is shown by the arrows going away. What could be happening here? You have zero force for a while as you approach, and then suddenly there's a negative force. It just suddenly reaches a negative force. And then there's a little plateau between z equal to zero and z equal to 250, and then suddenly you hit pretty much a vertical wall in Fz. Right? But again, you have to be careful, because it's not really vertical, because if you look at the axes, the y and x axes, it turns out, I'll give you a hint, that the end part of the slope, which looks nearly vertical, its slope in terms of deflection versus sample position is actually 1. It's just the scale is weird, because the x-axis is thousands of angstroms, y-axis is 10, but really the slope there is 1. So, not surprisingly, the very end, the very fact that the tail end there has a slope equal to 1, in this graph, which is cantilever deflection versus Z, suggests that you are, at the very end, hitting a effectively infinitely stiff substrate, right? If I were to plot force versus Z, that would have a slope of K, cantilever stiffness. If I plot just cantilever deflection versus Z, it has a 45-degree line, pretty much, okay? Which means, basically, once I hit a hard surface, whatever Z I move, that's the amount of cantilever deflection, because the surface doesn't deform anymore. So that'll be a 45-degree line, or slope of 1. Okay, so whereas on the way back, you're getting this interesting hysteresis, because on the way back, you go a different way, and then you see for a very long distance, there's a long hysteresis that happens, okay? So what is happening in this case is very interesting. You have a hard surface, I believe it's silicon, yes? And then you have like a 25 nanometer layer of a polymeric liquid sitting on it. So what ends up happening is, first, the tip of cantilever approaches the sample, and you've got a very thick layer of liquid, and at a certain critical distance, the liquid just wicks up, forming a meniscus, really causing an instant negative force as it's trying to, the surface tension tries to pull the cantilever down. That's the first jump down you get as you approach the sample, right? You see that? So that's this one. That's the first snap in, if you will, that occurs. It's because the liquid just wicks up and sucks. Then, surprisingly, that force remains at a constant negative value for about 25 nanometers, which means the tip is then pressing through for 25 nanometers until, because that's the thickness of the liquid, right? Until it hits the silicon. And just before it hits the silicon, there's a little dip in force, right? Which suggests that there is some attractive force. You see this dip in force here? That means that there is some attractive force between the tip and the silicon. So you go to the situation. So there are two surfaces happening here, really. One is the surface between the liquid and the silicon, which behaves more like the infinitely stiff surface with attractive forces that I showed you, that it snaps in and pulls away. And then there's a second interface, which is the liquid-air interface, where it behaves more like the meniscus example that I showed you before. So you put the whole thing together and it becomes obvious what's happening. But, you know, it's pretty cool. You can start really understanding the physics of what's going on in this very nicely. Another really interesting thing that people do is what I call force extension curves. And here, instead of indenting the sample, it's like doing a tensile test, if you will, for the mechanics-oriented people here, on single molecules. So you can have a cantilever tip and you can have a single protein or DNA, tether it on the other side, and you pull on it, right? And in that case also, what you do is you change the Z. What you don't observe is, or what you don't measure directly is how much the cantilever bends and therefore what's the real separation. You don't measure that, you just change Z. This is a very classic experiment on Titan. It's a particular kind of protein which has many interesting domains, and this is a typical force versus, they call it extension here, Z. They don't call it Z piezo displacement like Capella and Kappel would call it. But look at this. Right? Pretty interesting, right? FZ curves. How would you interpret this? And how, if this is the FZ, what would FD be in this case? So all these are interesting questions, how to think about. And interestingly, you know, this is extension. If you look at approaching the sample, you get nice hysteresis. You know, it doesn't follow the same way. So these are all interesting things, and I think you're going to get a homework problem related to this particular force extension curve. Okay? So these are all FZ curves, but in doing FZ curves, you have to, in your mind, start converting it to FD, because FD is where the physics is. Okay? Any questions? Yeah?
Why did you start when you moved?
Yeah. So that long is actually, it turns out, so there are two hysteresis involved here. One is, good question. One is this one, right? One is this, what we would call short range hysteresis, in that when you come in, it goes this way. When you come out, it goes out of here. That's one. But the second one is that you're coming in, you have this, and then here you've got this long decay, and then it goes back to zero. Why does that happen? Well, that has to do with you have a polymeric liquid, 25 nanometers. So you touch the sample. When you come close to the sample, the liquid necks, gives you negative. When you move away, it's a polymer, liquid polymer. You're stretching it basically, 2,500 angstroms before it pops. So very good stuff. Okay, so now let's talk about some experimental situations. And when you do FZ curves, I hope you now know that in general you're going to get a flat part with zero force, and then there's going to be some snap into the sample, and you then are in contact, and you keep pushing down, and the cantilever deforms, it goes up, right? So there are typically two slopes. One is flat when there's no interaction, and the other on the left where you're interacting with the sample. If you look at that particular graph, you notice that when you're far from a sample, F is not equal to zero, right, in this case. And that would immediately tell you as you do an experiment that your laser is not centered in the photodiode. Remember that what happens in an AFM is there are two processes. First, you have to focus the laser spot on the cantilever, and then the reflected beam, you have to adjust the photodiode so the reflected beam falls in the center of the photodiode. Remember? We talked about that as well. And the basic idea of the photodiode is that the reflected spot should lie exactly in the middle. So if you move the photodiode up and down, there's usually a positioning screw for it. You should be able to get the reflected spot to lie exactly in the middle. And remember what it measures, a segmented photodiode measures. It measures intensity of light falling on the upper half minus the intensity of light on the lower half divided by the total intensity of incident light. Okay? So if you have it perfectly positioned in the middle, intensity on top minus intensity on bottom is zero, and you should get zero deflection. And that force curve should be zero when you're far from a sample. So when you're far from a sample, you want to adjust the photodiode position so that the deflection comes to zero, because it's not, it is zero, right? So that's something you have to do. But it's also important to keep in mind, this is a very important thing, is that your sensitivity of your FZ curve really depends on your spot, how it falls into the photodiode, okay? So these are four cases, B through E, that show the following situation. So let's say you begin with a situation where your laser spot is perfectly centered in the photodiode, so zero deflection, okay? Now, let's say you bring the cantilever, press on a sample. Let's say the cantilever bends by a certain amount, right? So the center of the reflected spot is going to move up by a certain amount. That little amount by which it moves up by is shown in B, C, D, E by the hatched area. That's the upwards motion of the center of the reflected spot. And it is the same in B, C, D, E, because we're simply comparing how, for the same deflection, what is the signal you're going to get out of the photodiode depending on the spot size. So the center of the spot in B through E has moved up by the same amount. Now we're going to look at what is the signal coming out of the photodiode in these cases. Not surprisingly, if you have case B, which is a small spot, the change in voltage you would expect is the largest compared to a situation where you have a large spot. Can you guys see that? Why? Because remember, what the photodiode output is equal to intensity on top minus intensity on bottom divided by total intensity. Okay? Now, think about it. If your spot size were as small as the deflection, right? So let's say your spot is here and you're in the middle and you deflect it and your entire spot moves up into the top half, right? If the entire spot moves up, you'll get a huge change in voltage, right? Because you have voltage on top minus voltage bottom divided by total. You get the largest change the smaller the spot is. If the spot is very, very big in the photodiode, the same amount of motion causes a very little relative change in voltage output out of the photodiode, right? So what you ideally want is to have a very small spot located, centered exactly at the middle of the photodiode. Larger spots bring much more noise. For the same cantilever deflection, you see much less signal out of it, relatively speaking. Another important thing is sometimes you have these bizarre situations where your reflected laser spot is not perfectly circular. It can be oblong in certain directions. And if it is, you can get very bizarre effects. For example, in case D, the motion of the cantilever up and down a little amount causes not much change in photodiode voltage in D. However, if the same oblong nature were oriented horizontally, the same height would cause a much larger change in areas on top and bottom, and therefore would give a larger signal. So the positioning of the laser spot is sort of critical to improve the sensitivity of an FZ curve. Okay? Any questions on that? So we're going to go through some practical aspects of FZ curves here. Another thing that often happens, especially folks who are doing FZ curves in large Z ranges, is, remember, at large Z, what should the force be when the Z is large, when you're far enough from the sample? Force should be zero if you're far enough. But in reality, if you do your FZ typically over 200 nanometer Z ranges or 300 nanometers, you start seeing funny things that you know, in what is considered the non-contact zero force range, you start seeing wavy forces. Now, before you jump to the conclusion that you have discovered a new force of nature, you should simply look at artifacts, right? And this is a very common thing that happens, and basically it has to do with the fact that typically the lasers we use for monitoring cantilever deflection are wavelengths somewhere between, let's say around 600 nanometers, sometimes 400 nanometers. So what ends up happening is the laser spot falls on the cantilever, but if it's not perfectly positioned or if the laser spot is much bigger than the cantilever, some of that signal falls on the sample and comes back to the photodiode, right? So the photodiode gets two signals, one coming from reflected from the sample, another from the cantilever. And the difference between them can be an integer multiple or a fraction, integer fraction of the wavelength, causing constructive or destructive interference at the photodiode, right? So you want to avoid, and that's what ends up happening. It turns out that there is some periodicity associated with these wavy things, and it has to do with the trigonometry of the beam deflection system, wavelength of the laser, and so on. So the way to solve this is, of course, to make sure that your laser spot is entirely on the cantilever, or if your laser spot is really too big, change your laser, make it a smaller laser. Another thing that a lot of AFM systems are now doing to avoid these kind of things, by the way, there are only a handful of applications where you need to move your Z distance by more than 100 nanometers. 100 nanometers is long. It's a long Z range in AFM. All right. There's only a handful of applications. So if you're doing AFM, your Z range should not be more than 100 nanometers ever, except under special conditions. Those special conditions, for example, are maybe you're looking at indentation of live cells or something where really big fluffy objects, or you're pulling polymers, or you're pulling individual protein molecules and so on. So what's happening these days is they try to use non-coherent lasers. So instead of having a single wavelength, let's say you mix up the different wavelengths in there, and so you don't get such a stark periodicity due to constructive and destructive interference because you've mixed up all the wavelengths that are there. So they use these non-coherent lasers these days to minimize this effect. There are other artifacts in FZ curves. One shown on the top is typical. You approach, you're red, you retract, you're in green, and they don't line up. And one of the first things you would do is you got Z piezohysteresis. You know, piezos aren't perfect materials, and you apply a positive voltage and you apply the same negative, you expect the piezo to come back to the same position. It doesn't. You apply a positive voltage and you apply same negative voltage, you don't come back to the same point because there is hysteresis in the material, in the Z piezo material. And so one way to get over that is you just keep doing it over and over again until it warms up and the hysteresis reduces. The other way these days is to use what are called closed-loop piezos, which when you want it to move by 10 nanometers, it actually measures how much it actually moved and makes sure it reaches that point, right? So they have sensors built in that detect how much the Z piezo moved and so on. Another important thing that happens is you could be doing FZ curves very fast, and you can imagine, especially in liquids, if you move very fast, even if you're not contacting the surface, you're moving through a liquid, right? As you move through a liquid, there's drag and the cantilever bends up, right? And when you move away, it bends the other way. So if you do it very fast, the hydrodynamic drag on the cantilever causes a hysteresis between approach and retraction because the velocities are in opposite direction, the drag forces act in opposite direction. You need to be aware of that. One very important thing. Most people in AFM, when they start, this graph, force versus indentation, is done in volts. Because many people just don't bother about converting volts into nanometers, into nanonewtons, okay? It's terrible because of the following reason. You guys need to have an idea of what are the forces you should apply in AFM. In AFM, I guess in my opinion, I'm sure Ron will agree, you never want to apply more than 100 nanonewtons of force. This is upper, beyond that, all kinds of crazy things start happening. 100 nanonewtons is, for an AFM person, it is hammer. You're doing hammer at that point, right? But people do use it, and if they do it properly, they do get interesting results. But 100 nanonewtons is like absolutely upper limit. You shouldn't be using AFM beyond that. If you are, you're damaging the tip. You're doing all kinds of things. So this is an example. So as soon as you see this, you look at the force, micronewtons. As soon as you see someone plotting micronewtons, you should just get up and red flag should come off. And you should say, oh my goodness, this is crazy. You're applying super huge forces. Things are deforming, breaking, all kinds of stuff. And in this case, it is intentional. In this case, people use AFM for what's called nanoindentation. You actually try to plastically deform the surface. And in those cases, you typically go to micronewton forces. If you are doing this, my suggestion is don't use an AFM. Use what's called a nanoindenter, which does it better. But you start getting these huge loops that happen because here the dashed line shows a Hertz contact model. At a certain critical point, you've crossed the yield point of the material starts yielding, and you get this huge plastic deformation of the material, of the tip, everything, right? So having studied the different artifacts that you might get in FZ curves and understood the difference between FZ and FD, in this slide, we're looking into probably the most important use of FD curves, okay? So in this particular case, you see an interesting sample, which is a carbon fiber composite material, the kind, for example, that's used for building things like airplanes, like the Boeing Dreamliner, for example, is a carbon fiber composite. On the top right, you actually see a topography image, and the circular objects are actually cross-sections of carbon fibers that are typically 2 to 3 microns in diameter. And filled in between them is a epoxy, a material that binds everything together, right? So this is the kind of stuff that the Boeing Dreamliner, for example, is made of. So there's a lot of interest, for example, in probing what are the elastic properties of the material, the epoxy that holds these fibers together, for example. So one way to do this is the AFM, because in particular, if you look at the gaps between the carbon fibers, they range from a few nanometers when the fibers are very close together to a few microns. So what is expected actually is that the polymer or the epoxy properties ought to change in these small regions in between the fibers due to two effects. One due to, natural heterogeneity that may happen in the epoxy, but also it is expected that the organization or the molecular structure of the epoxy itself could be different in bulk compared to when it's right next to a carbon fiber. So there are two reasons why people are interested in understanding this, because ultimately the failure of these kind of composite materials happens at the interface between the carbon fiber and the epoxy. So understanding the epoxy properties becomes very relevant. Okay, so what one does, not surprisingly, is you're going to do, if you're asked to do this, it's a very typical measurement you have to do, find the elastic modulus of a material. So you would do FZ curves, and what is shown, for example, here is the, what I've plotted is, instead of F, I've plotted the cantilever deflection, so F is simply deflection times the cantilever stiffness, right? So this is just deflection, but it's going to be F, it's the same as F, because F is K times this quantity. Versus the ZP is a displacement. You typically want to do multiple replicates of an experiment. You should never report elastic modulus from one FZ curve. You do multiple ones. And the other thing I'm going to suggest to you is for elastic modulus and actually for measuring adhesion, you should use the retraction curve. There's an important reason for doing it. Especially adhesion, you have to do retraction curves anyway. Because doing retraction, you make sure that you sample, like in the FD curve, you've got a bottom of the minimum force of the FD curve. To sample the very bottom, you need to pull out, you need to retract. If you just approach, you snap in, you don't really see the very bottom. So the suggestion is, if you're going to use one FZ curve for getting both elastic modulus and adhesion, that it should be the retraction curve, because you'll get the right number for adhesion as well. So you do multiple FZ curves, as shown here, at the same point, or you could sample different points in the region on the polymer. Okay? Now, I hope you all know how to convert FZ to FD. Right? Everybody knows how to do this. We discussed it just a few slides ago. But effectively, this is the FD that comes out of the process. And when you do FD, remember, the issue of where D equal to zero lies is an important issue. A good way to do this is to set the minimum force you get in the FD as the D equal to zero, the minimum one, okay? So that's what has been done here. D equal to zero corresponds to minimum of the FD curves, okay? So now you're asked to find out what is the elastic modulus of the sample. The way to do this is when you look at an FD curve, you first have to decide, okay, what is the correct tip-sample interaction model I'm going to fit to this FD curve to back out an elastic modulus, correct? I mean, that's what we're going to do. So when you look at this, you've done many different examples of FD curves, right? Which model do you think fits best here or would be appropriate? Could I simply use a Van der Waals 1 over D squared law to match this? And the answer is no, because clearly what you see is, you know, there's some attractive force, but there's a repulsive force also, right? Would you rather use a Leonard Jones kind of interaction? And the answer is probably not, because Leonard Jones between a sphere and a hard surface, when you integrate through the volume, does not allow for indentation. You know, D cannot become zero. It's 1 over D to the some power, so D goes to zero, it blows up, right? It's Leonard Jones is between, you know, infinitely hard objects interacting with each other. So what do you do? Well, the most obvious thing that happens, that comes to mind for this particular sample would be something like the DMT contact mechanics model, which you have studied, which involves a Van der Waals 1 over D squared law up to a certain point, and when you touch the sample, it's like a Hertzian contact mechanics law. Okay, so if that's what you would do, remember, when you choose D equal to zero, D being negative means that's the amount of indentation. D is positive, it's a separation between the tip and the sample. All right. So in this particular case, for example, you might want to take every curve that is to the left of D equal to zero, or look at the region to the left of D equal to zero, and you might want to fit that curve to the DMT model as shown. So the DMT model would suggest that the force goes as a force of adhesion, which is the minimum value of the force you would see here, plus this D to the 3/2 dependent. D is the indentation. That's from the Hertz contact. You studied all this, right? In the lecture Professor Reifenberger gave a few classes ago. Right, so in Hertz contact mechanics, what happens is the force you apply scales its indentation to the 3/2. And that has to do fundamentally with, in contact mechanics, the area of contact actually evolves. It's not like putting two flat plates and pressing them together. The amount of area of contact changes because it's sphere plane contact. And that's why you get this 3/2 power law, even though the underlying constitutive properties of the elastic material are linear, but the geometry of contact introduces a nonlinearity in the process. Okay? Alright, so you would basically then for each curve, fit each curve to the left of D equal to zero with this particular law, and you would try to back out E star and F adhesion from each curve. Those are parameter fits that you would, those are parameters that you would fit, for example, in MATLAB using least squares or something, okay? And you would get for every, and R is the tip radius, so you have to supply tip radius in this, in these kind of calculations, right? And the typical way to get a tip radius is you do really high resolution. There are many ways to get a tip radius. We'll probably talk about it later in the class, but you probably don't want to use what the supplier suggests to you because it's going to be off completely. So you want to take very high resolution scanning electron microscope images of two orthogonal planes of the tip, because, you know, a tip can appear sharp this way, but you look at it in another plane, it can be more like a wedge. So typically you do it, SEM images in two orthogonal planes, but high resolution, so like FESEM, so field-enhanced SEM images, and try to fit the radius of a circle to those images that you see and use that radius here. That's probably the best way to do it. There are other ways. You can You can, for example, scan gratings of known sizes and try to back out what the tip radius is using tip deconvolution software called SPIP. We'll talk about these things later in the class, but all those things are possible, but perhaps the easiest non-destructive way is to take high-resolution SEM images to orthogonal planes and try to fit as best as you can appropriate tip radius to the tip. So that number goes in here, and then you're basically, for every set of points here, you're basically trying to get the best E-star and best adhesion value that matches the curve. And so for every curve, you're going to get a value of F-adhesion and a value of E-star. E-star is the effective Young's modulus between the tip and the sample, which, again, the formula for it in terms of the Young's modulus of the sample and the Young's modulus of the tip and the Poisson's ratios of the two has been given to you two lectures ago. Now, you can choose, there are many other models, right? You can go to Sneddon models, Oliver Farr analysis. There are many different models. Here, just by looking at this, I would say the DMT is a good model and you go with it, okay? But when you start doing very large indentations, like the indentation here, check it out, it's just half a nanometer is the indentation, right? Which is very small, it's 5 angstroms, the indentation. So, but when you start doing very large indentations in very soft materials, you can't approximate it as a sphere anymore, and you have to go to Oliver Farr kind of analysis that allow you to put in force indentation curves for conical indenters, for cylindrical indenters, conical with spherical tips. There are a lot of modifications of those things also available. Okay, but you know, for most polymers like this, this is reasonable. Maybe for really soft polymers, you might go to JKR kind of models, okay? So this is very important, and your homework problem, you're asked to do this. We'll actually give you this data exactly on this composite material, and you're going to be asked to back out elastic modulus from it, all right? So FZ is what you observe. You have to convert to FD, and from FD, you have to fit, you have to set D equal to zero and then do a best fit to some model and get the elastic modulus of the polymer that resides in between the carbon fiber composites, carbon fibers. Okay, so let's go on to, you know, now that we know FZ, FD, let's just quickly look at what else you can do. Of course, the main reason for FZ, FD is to be able to measure the fundamental physics of interactions between the tip and the sample. Here's an example, a very nice animation from our collaborators in Spain that, you know, shows how the liquid neck forms, and as you pull away, the cantilever rings as you pull away from it. And of course, from FD curves, as we saw last time, you can even study precisely these meniscus forces as well that you might get on liquid films. So a lot of interesting physics is there, but when it was realized that the force versus Z curve you know, has a certain slope, the thought was, well, just like in tunneling microscopy, where you used V versus I, you could use, you know, force versus Z and do a feedback on the observed force and scan over the sample by keeping the force constant, right? Just like in tunneling, you would keep the tunneling current constant. You could feedback, move the base of the cantilever up and down in order to keep the force constant. And that's where contact mode imaging came out. Okay? So the tip first contacts the surface. You keep pressing down on it until you reach a certain set point force, and then you simply scan over the sample, keeping the force constant. Now, how do you keep the force constant? Well, if you hit a bump, right, the cantilever is going to deflect. So the force measured by it changes. Well, what's going to happen is the controller is going to say, well, oh, the cantilever deflection changed, so the force changed. I'm going to move the base of the cantilever back up in order to keep the deflection constant, cantilever deflection constant. If the cantilever deflection is constant over a scan, the force applied on the sample is constant, because the force applied is simply cantilever stiffness times cantilever deflection. And in doing so, the amount that the base of the cantilever has to move to keep the force constant is rendered as topography of the sample. So the blue curve, for example, would be how the base of the cantilever had to move up and down in order to keep the force constant as you scanned over a step edge, right? And so you do that at different lines, and you start rastering across the sample, and, you know, you get these blue curves one by one, which you assemble into a two-dimensional surface image. Okay, that's how contact mode AFM works. But again, I hope you realize that understanding FZ, FD is essential to choosing the appropriate force at which you do it, right? Let's say you apply a very large force where you're beyond the yield point of the material, then, you know, you're getting information, but you're not sure what you're doing because you're really yielding the material underneath the tip. Another thing you might be doing by mistake is you might choose a set point that corresponds to the tip still being inside the liquid layer that sits on top of your sample and not physically touching the sample, in which case you might be imaging the surface of the liquid film that sits on top of the solid. So these are all things that when you do contact mode imaging, keep in mind that you have to understand the FZ, FD, the surface physics, and then choose the appropriate forces so you understand what image you're getting. While you do contact force or contact mode imaging, you can also, of course, get to lateral forces, because now that you're sort of pressing down and dragging the cantilever over the tip, not surprisingly, you have a lateral force developing, which is due to friction, right? Which will twist the cantilever. And as we have discussed, you can measure the twisting of the cantilever by looking at how the reflected laser spot in the photodiode moves left and right, right? So you can measure that also, as shown here, as the cantilever twists, you expect the reflected laser spot to move in a way that's orthogonal to what it would move if it just bent up and down. So remember, the photodiode, what it measures is effectively the bending angle, the angle at the end of the tip, right? Because the location of the spot really changes due to a change in angle of the cantilever, right? In the same way, when it twists this way, it's the twisting angle that's measured in the photodiode signal. And using that, you know, you can measure some very interesting properties. For example, on the bottom left is an example of self-assembled monolayers that are stamped on a surface. And these monolayers, the ones in white, are actually monolayers of molecules. They're probably a nanometer high. So if you just did a topography image, and they're very soft, if you did a topography image, you would barely see these rectangular pads on the surface, because they're just 1 nanometer high and they're soft and they're sitting on a sample, on a hard sample. So you do contact mode imaging, you might just squeeze these molecules so that you don't see much of a topography image. But when you monitor the friction channel, you just see it a lot, because not surprisingly, the lateral forces depend on the chemistry and the molecular structure of what you're scanning over, right? And of course, contact mode has other interesting things you can do with it. Our friends here have been doing local oxidation lithography with it, which also you can do in contact mode effectively. But basically, the idea is when you're in contact, you can do many things, like you can actually deposit molecules. So you make a liquid neck, meniscus, and you can start transferring molecules as you do. You could be writing molecules just like a fountain pen, for example. That's the famous dip pen lithography technique that comes out of Northwestern University. You can also, while you're in contact, apply a voltage. And, you know, you can use this liquid meniscus that develops. And if you have a liquid meniscus, you apply a voltage, you basically have an electrochemical cell. You have electrochemistry happening in a very small, tiny, confined volume. And electrochemistry can be used to modify the chemical composition of the parts of the sample that you write on. So a quick, rapid overview of, you know, yeah, we're doing force distance curves to study fundamental forces, but ultimately you're going to use it for contact mode. When you do contact mode, you can do friction force, you can do lithography, a lot of interesting things. So the implications of understanding FZ sort of filter into all these different things, right? What set point forces would you choose for these kind of applications? Okay, so we're going to have about 3 lectures dealing with dynamic AFM, but for now, this is just a brief intro, and we need to do this before the next class, which is on calibration methods, because many calibration methods use dynamic properties of cantilevers, okay? But basically, yeah, you go back to a lecture, 2 lectures ago, where we talked about, you have a cantilever, you apply a point force, the cantilever bends, and the equation of the bent curve is, anyone remember? Is it a sine function? Is it a So if I take a cantilever, just apply point force, it bends in a curve. Is it a sine function, cosine function, as a function of x? Anyone remember? Is it an exponential function of x? Does it go exponentially? Anyone remember? Got your notes in front of you. Sine. No. So again, I think the lecture that was, I was not here for it and was recorded, please look into it. It's a cubic polynomial. So when you press on it from here, the shape is actually a cubic polynomial as a function of x. However, what ends up happening if you take an AFM cantilever and start shaking it, right? And this is an experimental measurement of how this thing moves up and down. What happens is every cantilever has a resonance frequency and multiple resonance frequency, just like a guitar string, you know, has a first eigenmode, you know, that goes like that. The second eigenmode is more, or you can have an acoustic cavity, very similar things. In the same way you have with cantilevers, you have these eigenmodes. And when you do dynamic AFM, you choose to drive it at one particular eigenmode typically. Now you look at this, this is what's called the fundamental eigenmode, right? It's oscillating like this, but at a very specific frequency, right? Now, what ends up happening is, so this is a dynamically evolving shape now. It's going up and down, changing with time. However, you can show that the temporal motion is just basically a sine wave, but the shape just evolves up and down. But the shape, although it looks very much like what you might expect when you apply the point force at the end, this shape is not described by a polynomial, you know, cubic polynomial. It's not. It turns out it's described by something else, a combination of sines and sine hyperbolics and things. Although on the face of it, it looks just like you applied this way. In reality, it's actually more complicated. All right. But what ends up happening when you do dynamic AFM is that there are many modes in dynamic AFM. You can have what are called amplitude modulated modes. You can have frequency modulated modes. There are also things called phase modulated modes, many different modes. But effectively, what you do is you drive this cantilever at resonance at some amplitude. If you do amplitude modulation, what you do is you scan over the sample and you monitor the amplitude and you control it, right? And so if the amplitude changes for whatever reason, you move the base of the cantilever up to keep the amplitude constant. And then you render as topography the amount that you move the cantilever up and down in order to keep amplitude constant. Hence, amplitude modulation. Okay? There are other mechanisms. Frequency modulation. Frequency modulation is the chosen mode for extremely high resolution imaging. For example, in air and in vacuum, there are about, while there might be one or two papers on the use of amplitude modulation to get atomic resolution, frequency modulation, there are hundreds of papers that yield atomic resolution images in vacuum and in air. Okay? So amplitude modulation is also often called tapping mode. Frequency modulation is sometimes called non-contact AFM, but it's not true. I think it should be called frequency modulation. So in FM-AFM, what you do is you scan. Not only do you keep amplitude constant, you also keep frequency shift constant, you keep the phase of the oscillator constant. You scan with three feedback loops when you do frequency modulation. Very complicated stuff, right? Anyhow, this is a brief introduction to dynamic AFM. This is the point I was trying to raise, that if you look below, you know, when you try to think of, okay, well, we're going to move to dynamic AFM, how are we going to think about modeling it? The first, you know, historically, the first model that came out was a point mass model. And the whole idea of point mass model is, you know, let us assume that the cantilever is basically a spring, okay? And the mass, the tip acts as a tip mass, okay? So you got a spring with a tip mass at the end of it. The underlying assumptions in that model are that, so what people do is they're simply going to use the cantilever spring constant K as the spring and put a tip at the end of it. They say that should be okay. But if you think about it, the cantilever spring constant calculation assumes that it bends as a cubic polynomial when you have a static force applied to it. And when that is true, we derive this expression, cubic polynomial, when you have point force applied at the end, you get the relationship that theta to delta, theta is the bending angle that you actually measure, delta is the actual deflection, are related by 2/3 of the cantilever length, okay? However, in reality, when you drive the first eigenmode of the cantilever at resonance, the shape, psi of x, in which it vibrates, is no longer a cubic polynomial. It is a more complicated expression. We're going to do this in detail, don't worry. This is a quick, I have to do a bit of dynamic AFM before we get to calibration methods. That's why we're doing this, all right? So the shape is different. It involves cosines and hyperbolics and stuff. As a result, the ratio of theta to delta is not 2L over 3. Okay? So these are important things to keep in mind. All right? But nonetheless, when you do a point mass model, you assume you can simply use the cantilever stiffness due to a point force and just replace the entire cantilever by a spring with a little bob at the end of it, the tip at the end of it. Okay? All right. We'll look at all these things in detail a little more, okay? And then, of course, there are issues. As we go forward, we're going to look at, for example, how the method of exciting this resonance changes what you observe, and there are many ways of doing it. So we'll consider all this in detail a little later. Just a little brief intro to dynamic AFM. And in the next lecture, we'll be looking at calibration methods. And one of the important things we need to calibrate is the stiffness of these eigenmodes as well. So we'll talk about that, okay? Thank you very much.